Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the late May calendar of the California Supreme Court. The clerk will call this morning's calendar. Proceed initially in the matter of Viva International versus Adidas, hearing first from Ms. Degani.
May it please the court. Both Justices Kennedy and Stevens of the U.S. Supreme Court have warned that the conflict preemption doctrine is a potentially boundless doctrine that is capable of damaging our system of government's delicate federal and state balance of power by rendering a vast undefined area of state law vulnerable to invalidation.
So what is the state law that we are concerned with, and what is the federal law on the other side?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
Obviously, the main issue here pertains to preemption. And to be more particular, we have a state law and there's a federal law. Presumably, this court would have to consider the interplay between the state law and the federal law. My question to you is, well, what do we have in the state law? What do we have in the federal law? And why should we agree with you with whatever argument you intend to present to this court?
The state law is Penal Code Section 653-0, which prohibits the importation and sale of any products made of kangaroo in California. And the federal law that the defendants are claiming is preemptive is the Endangered Species Act. Now, the Endangered Species Act at this time and since 1995 has had nothing to say about kangaroos. Are the three species of kangaroos.
So more particularly, why should we agree with you that I presume your position is there is no preemption, right?
Correct.
I would like to hear your summary of the arguments with which you would like us to agree with you. And then, of course, we'll hear from the other side.
The Endangered Species Act has an express preemption provision that says that the states can protect species that are not on the federal list. The three kangaroo species that are at issue here are not on the federal list.
But express preemption, of course, is not the only kind of preemption there is.
It
can occupy the field. There can be other aspects of federal law that preempt. So why is it that you feel that you overcome each of the types of hurdles that preemption potentially can pose?
Well, the defendants here are expressly not claiming express preemption or occupation of the field, as they've said in their briefs. And they couldn't because, obviously, expressly the Endangered Species Act does allow for state regulation and, therefore, does not occupy the field of regulating endangered species. So what they're claiming is conflict preemption. They're claiming there's a conflict between California's ban on importation and trade in these three kangaroo species and the Endangered Species Act because the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service at one point listed these three kangaroos as threatened and had a special rule that allowed importation of those three species into the United States.
Aren't they actually saying that there is an obstacle preemption in that the federal law was designed to encourage Australia to manage appropriately the kangaroo, And when and Australia has done so, and kangaroo are now prolific, and when California bans the importation of kangaroo, isn't the argument that this conflicts with the federal carrot and stick approach? The stick is, we will ban importation if you don't manage your wildlife, and the carrot is, but if you do manage your wildlife, we'll let it come in. And California is now saying, you can't let these products come in.
That is the argument, but our position is that there is no evidence in this record that, in fact, that was what the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service was doing when it removed the kangaroo species, those three kangaroo species, from the threatened species list. It was not giving a carrot instead of a stick. What it was doing was simply determining, based on its own determination, that these species no longer required protection because they were sufficiently prolific, as you said. Now, the California legislature apparently disagrees with that, but the federal government has decided that the kangaroo species no longer satisfy the criteria for being listed as threatened. Therefore, they've been removed from the list.
But opposing counsel argues that after delisting, they could invoke the emergency listing procedures if necessary. What is wrong with that argument?
Well, the problem with that argument is that the emergency listing procedures can be invoked for absolutely any species, even a species that's never been on the list. So there's really no difference between a species that's never been listed and a species that's been delisted. And, in fact, the criteria for listing and delisting are exactly the same. So saying that if a species has been delisted, that species is still protected under the Act is saying that every species on the planet that could potentially ever be listed is protected under the Act, and therefore the states can't regulate those species. And that directly, of course, contradicts what the federal government wanted to have done, what Congress clearly expressed in its express preemption provision, where it said that it expects that the states will have more extensive regulations.
And now, as we seek to analyze the preemption issues in this case, do we start with a presumption against preemption?
Yes. There are several reasons for a presumption against preemption here. First, there's a traditional presumption against preemption in areas where the states are regulating a field that's traditionally regulated by the states. And the area of wildlife regulation is such an area.
But, counsel, as perhaps you're going to go on and tell us, this area involves matters of foreign affairs. And has the United States Supreme Court spoken to whether a presumption against preemption obtains when matters of foreign affairs are involved? For instance, in Crosby versus National Foreign Trade Council and American Insurance Association versus Garamondi?
What the court has said is that that presumption, the traditional presumption against preemption, is not triggered when the state is regulating in a field that the federal government has traditionally occupied. Not necessarily. In fact, in Garamondi and Crosby, the court specifically declined to say that every case in which the state regulates in a way that touches on foreign affairs is by definition preempted.
And where does that leave us, that there is a presumption, as you started to say?
There is a presumption because in the area of wildlife regulation, including the area of foreign wildlife, which is what we're dealing with here, that is not an area where the federal government has traditionally been regulating. The sorts of cases where the court has said that there is no presumption are cases like the Locke case.
What about the relatively recent case, I believe 2004, the Bronco Wine case,
yes,
which this court decided and applied a presumption against preemption? Now,
right,
of course, that does not, as Justice Werger pointed out, involve international commerce, but do you think that that case assists you?
Absolutely, I think it does, because in that case the court went through a lengthy explanation of why the regulation at issue there, which was regulation of alcoholic beverages, was not an area that, although the federal government had gotten involved in it, it was an area that the states had been regulating long before the federal government started asserting its interest, and there was always a concurrent regulation, and that's exactly what's happened with the area of endangered species regulation. The states have been regulating since the 1800s. The federal government started regulating in the early 1900s with the Lacey Act, which simply said that state violations of state wildlife regulations could be prosecuted as a federal law violation, but it didn't have any of its own regulations. And it didn't implement its own regulations until the 1960s. So this is very much an area where the states have been very active long before the federal government, and a presumption against preemption does apply. Not only that, but we're dealing here with a situation where we're talking about conflict preemption, which, although there can be preemption, even if there's an express preemption provision, there can be conflict preemption still. Nonetheless, there's a presumption against it, because if the federal government has taken the time to carve out an express preemption provision, then the court should be very careful not to find conflict where the federal government hasn't specifically said that there is a conflict. So I want to talk a little bit about the kinds of evidence that both the U.S. Supreme Court and this court have used to show that conflict preemption exists. And my basic premise is that what needs to be shown is that there is a clear federal policy, a clearly expressed federal policy that causes some clear that is somehow clearly damaged by the state law at issue. So, for example, in Garamendi, there was the German Foundation Agreement, and there was a joint statement by the American and German governments and the governments of Israel and five Eastern European countries, all expressly recognizing that it would be in the policy interest of the United States and in the participants' interest for the foundation to be the exclusive remedy and forum for all Holocaust-era claims against German companies. That was expressed. There were also consistent statements from high-level executive officials, and the court went into great detail at pages 422 through 423 of the decision, talking about the statements made by various officials, including Deputy Secretary Eisenstadt, said the U.S. government has supported the ICH-EIC since it began, and we believe it should be considered the exclusive remedy. He said that a company's participation in the ICH-EIC should give it a safe haven from sanctions, subpoenas, and hearings relative to the Holocaust period, and the national interest in maintaining amicable relationships with current European allies, survivors' interests in a fair and prompt and non-adversarial resolution of their claims, and the company's interest in securing legal peace when they settle claims in this fashion. All of these were reasons that there was a policy, a clearly expressed policy of the federal government stated by these executive officials that the court latched onto in deciding that the California law at issue there was in conflict. There was also an amicus brief filed by the United States saying this is our policy. Our policy is that this body should be the exclusive remedy for these sorts of claims.
So you're contrasting our concern with the kangaroos with this other situation,
exactly.
And you're saying it doesn't
exactly
obtain. The Court of Appeal and the trial court both felt that that California's effort to regulate the importation of kangaroo was in conflict with federal law. And as I understand it, they reached that conclusion based on the express preemption part of the Endangered Species Act, which prohibited states from prohibiting what the federal government has authorized. Am I correct so far?
Yes.
And the federal government, and the argument they made there, and I'm going to ask you to respond, is that the federal government has, or maybe I got it backwards, no, the federal government has authorized the importation of kangaroo parts. And under the express preemption provisions of the Endangered Species Act, California is now prohibiting it. Would you respond to that?
Yes, absolutely. The federal government has not authorized the importation of kangaroo parts.
But they're permitted, are they not?
They're not prohibited. There's currently no federal prohibition against it because they are no longer listed as threatened.
How does that differ from an authorization?
Well, as this court stated in the Bronco Wine case, it's very different to not prohibit something and to make it legal, especially in a case like this where the federal government has specifically stated that the states can pass regulations that are stricter than the federal government. So not prohibiting it simply means that the federal government takes no position on it, but it does not take away the right of the state to take a position and say, no, we believe that trade in this particular product should be prohibited.
Now, isn't there a provision in the Federal Act that expressly authorizes the importation of species?
Something in the Federal Act that expressly authorizes
or permits, and then that's not implicated in
there's
this.
There's a regulation that permits the Secretary to make determinations for threatened species. Endangered species, and actually, I don't think it applies to endangered species. And threatened species is all that we're dealing with here. And there is
in any event, as to these species, the federal government has not expressly authorized or permitted their importation, made a special exception for them.
Not as of 1995. They did in 1981, and we're not claiming that between 1981 and 1995 it would have been possible to enforce the California law against importing kangaroos. But since 1995, when kangaroos were delisted and that special rule that allowed their importation was rescinded, there's been no federal position on these kangaroos, and since then California has been free to do as it wants with respect to these species.
Well, if every state, not just California, but every state took upon itself to individually regulate endangered species and say that, in this case, kangaroo couldn't be imported, what would that do with the federal government's ability to implement its own policy?
Well, again, that depends on what you think the federal policy is. And our position is I'm assuming from your question that the federal government's policy is what the defendants claim, which is to encourage Australia to conserve kangaroos by allowing the importation of kangaroos into this country. And that's
well, that was true at one time, was it not?
Not even really in 1981. If you read the Federal Register, what they did was they said that as of 1981, they believed that the species were sufficiently abundant that there was no longer a reason not to permit their importation, but that there was a danger that they would become threatened again because they're such a cyclical creature and Australia subject to droughts, and it affects the kangaroos so devastatingly that they felt that it was necessary to keep them on the threatened species list to monitor what was happening for a period longer. But there's actually, you can read the Federal Register with a fine-tooth comb, as I have, and I recommend a magnifying glass for your eyes, and there's nothing in there about incentivizing Australia to implement conservation measures. In fact, the Federal Register recognizes that Australia has its own incentive, that these are a national, kangaroos are a national symbol for Australia, and that it is itself motivated to preserve them. And in fact, Australia, in its amicus brief before this court, has confirmed that. It said that it is motivated to preserve the kangaroos, that it has implemented regulations that it claims are sufficient, and it has made no indication that it plans to stop conserving them or to stop any of these measures that it has implemented if any American market is not open to it. Of course, all it said is, we'd like all the markets to be open. We don't think there's any reason for them not to be, but it has not said we won't conserve them any longer if we can't import them into the United States. Setting that aside, if every state in the Union all of a sudden decided not to permit importation of kangaroos and the federal government thought that that was a problem, they could always put them back on the list and permit their importation, at which point the state governments would not be able to pass a conflicting law.
So does it appear in the record what percentage of the U.S. market is devoted to California?
There actually isn't anything in the record about what percentage of the U.S. market is devoted to California, but there is evidence that the entire U.S. market for kangaroos is very small, only about 5% of what's imported or exported out of Australia. So the impact, even if all of the states in the Union decided to ban importation of kangaroo, would be minimal. And in fact, the Fish and Wildlife Service says in the Federal Register that Australia is going to do with the kangaroos what it's going to do regardless of what the United States does. It's going to continue to kill the kangaroo, and it's also going to continue to do what it thinks are sufficient measures to preserve them, although California obviously disagrees that those measures are sufficient. So I just want to get back to some of the things that both this court and the U.S. Supreme Court have said are necessary in order to show that what the federal policy is in order to find conflict preemption and to show that there's damage to that policy. And as I said in Garamendi, there was an executive agreement, there were statements by high-level executive officials, there was an amicus brief filed by the United States explaining what the policy was and saying that there was a conflict with the California state law, and there were also protests from other countries, Germany and Switzerland in particular, saying this California law is impinging on our ability to work through this deal that we've struck with the United States and with other countries to make reparations for what happened during the Holocaust, and is an obstacle. So there was clear damage that was being expressed by the United States and by other countries. Same with Crosby. In the Crosby case, there was a congressional act that specifically delegated authority to the president to decide what kinds of sanctions to impose on Burma, and specifically said that the president should have flexibility and that it shouldn't be there shouldn't be one kind of very heavy-handed sanctions without regard to what was happening politically.
Ms. Tagani, I'm afraid your time is up, assuming you wish to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
I do. Thank you very much.
Hear now from Mr. Feinman.
Honorable Chief Justice and Associate Justices of the Supreme Court, may it please the Court, I am Martin Feinman of Davis Wright Tremaine, LLP, on behalf of the respondents, Adidas Promotional Retail Operations, Sport Chalet, and Offsite Soccer. The question before the Court is whether a California statute, Penal Code Section 653.0, may forbid and indeed criminalize the importation and trade in kangaroo products when federal law expressly authorizes that trade.
Well, let's go to that very word, authorizes. We were just hearing from opposing counsel that to fail to prohibit doesn't mean authorize, if I got that correctly. Authorize is a positive statement, and the preemptive provisions of the federal act would say that California can't do what it's doing if in fact the federal act authorizes importation of kangaroo parts.
Yes, Your Honor. I would refer the Court to page 439 of the record, which is an excerpt from the Federal Register, one of the various actions that the Fish and Wildlife Service of the Department of Interior took. And it said, and if I may quote just a sentence, importation is now lawful. Interstate commerce is now appears also to be lawful. The service thus interprets its April 29, 1981 action as authorizing, pursuant to an exception provided for by regulation, the importation of and interstate commerce in the red, eastern gray, and western gray kangaroo. So in response to Your Honor's question, that's precisely the action.
Well, it's descriptive of what federal law has done by ceasing to list the kangaroo, which may not be the same as the federal law in its terms saying we authorize importation of kangaroo parts.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand the distinction that opposing counsel has drawn, but the exact language of the Federal Register, the action taken by the federal government, is that importation is now lawful, that it is authorized.
And it's lawful. It's lawful because they have delisted the kangaroo. Is that correct?
That is part of the reason, Your Honor. There is the entire 30-plus-year history of the federal government involvement in the kangaroo and population management of the kangaroo. It goes all the way back to the original decision to list in 1973, right with the first enactment of the Endangered Species Act. Together with that, the federal government issued what was called the special rule that indicated that it was the U.S.'s view that Australia and the Australian states did not have adequate kangaroo management programs at that time, but that importation would be allowed when the Australian states provided satisfactory evidence that they did have.
If there is a cell phone on, even if not in use, that may be responsible for this kind of interference.
I beg your pardon.
If you had completed your answer, I wanted to ask you, are we faced here with a presumption against preemption, a presumption that we recognized in the Bronco Wine case, or is there something about the circumstance of this case involving foreign commerce or some other aspect of it that would indicate that that presumption does not apply?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the first point that I would like to make in response to that is that the Court of Appeal expressly recognized that there is this presumption, or some cases describe it as an assumption against preemption. And the Court of Appeal expressly recognized that presumption and applied it and ruled that, nevertheless, the presumption had been overcome in this case. There is an interesting question that Your Honor poses about whether the presumption, in fact, does apply in this case. This is different from the Bronco Wine case. The Bronco Wine case went on at very great length to detail that the presumption against preemption applied in that case because there was a very long history of state regulation of food, of drink, and of alcoholic beverage, wine in particular, that preceded federal regulation by many decades. And you see it stated not only in the Bronco Wine case, but in many cases of this court, that the presumption arises when there is a long history of state regulation. So one point I would like to make is that that differs from the case in front of the court today.
Isn't there a long history of state regulation of wildlife?
There is a long history of regulation of wildlife if one conceives of the issue that broadly or that abstractly. What is at issue here is kangaroo, which according to the record is not indigenous to California, is not native to California. There are no kangaroos in California. This is an issue of a California statute that purely purports to regulate international trade.
Well, does that mean that California couldn't regulate, or there would be a presumption that California could regulate the use of alligator products because alligators thrive in Florida but not in California? Do we look at it state by state that narrowly?
It's interesting, Your Honor, because actually alligator is an issue that's been litigated, and an injunction was issued against the enforcement of 653-0 with respect to alligator on grounds of preemption. That's the Folk versus Brown case that's been cited in the brief. I think your point is about this presumption against preemption. And the point I was trying to make was a narrow one. The broadest point is that the Court of Appeal did, in fact, apply the presumption and found that it was met. The second point that I'm trying to make is if we conceive the issue here as not a long history of state regulation of wildlife, but rather what is the duration of states purporting to regulate international commerce in wildlife, we see that, in fact, the federal government has regulated that issue longer than the states. There was a predecessor statute to the Endangered Species Act called the Endangered Species Conservation Act that long precedes 653-0 itself was enacted in 1970. The Endangered Species Act was adopted 3 years later in 1973. So we don't have the paradigm presented by the Bronco Wine case, where there was many decades of state regulation of the subject matter that long preceded the federal regulation. The third point that I wanted to make is one that I think came up in the questioning of Ms. Degani earlier, and that is the fact that the statute at issue here purports to regulate international commerce. And there is a case called Folk Company versus Mandel, a federal case, where a statute almost identical to 653-0 was held to be preempted. The court there indicated that more stringent standards of preemption apparently apply when foreign affairs, as opposed to purely domestic interests, are involved. And the court went on to quote from the United States Supreme Court in Hines versus Davidovitz, which is one of the seminal conflict preemption cases, where the Supreme Court said it is of importance that this legislation is in a field which affects international relations, the one aspect of our government that from the first has been most generally conceded imperatively to demand broad national authority. Any concurrent state power that may exist is restricted to the narrowest of limits. So this is an instance, Your Honor, where I think, in fact, there may not be a case for a presumption against preemption. But even if there is, as the Court of Appeal applied, I believe it's been met.
Well, what do you do with the Ninth Circuit case of H.J. Justin versus Duke Majin, which I understand a boot manufacturer sought preemption of this California Penal Code section with respect to the wallaby kangaroo? And the Ninth Circuit found that there was no preemption as our Penal Code section applied to unlisted species. Is that directly contrary to your position?
Not at all, Your Honor. There are three federal cases that have considered the section 653-0. It's the Manhing case, the Justin case, and Folk versus Brown case. All three, the most important point is that all three of those cases deal with express preemption and not with conflict preemption. They don't address conflict preemption whatsoever. The second most important point.
So are you telling me, and I'm not challenging you, I'm just informing myself, that the Justin case did not involve the same federal statute?
No, it did involve.
And the same Penal Code section.
Yes, it involved the Endangered Species Act.
Yes.
And
our Penal Code section.
That's exactly.
And aren't we here to determine whether conflict preemption is involved?
Yes, but the Manhing case, the Justin case, and the Folk case, none of those dealt with conflict preemption. They all dealt only with the question of express preemption. Recall, there are three different types of preemption.
Yes, of course.
Express, implied, mm-hmm. and conflict. All three dealt only with express preemption. That's the most important thing to know. The second point is that in all three cases, the court found that 653-0 was preempted, was expressly preempted. In Manhing, it was expressly preempted with respect to ivory, which is elephant parts. The Justin case, it was found to be preempted with respect to elephant parts once again, and not with respect to wallaby and python. And the Folk case, as I mentioned a moment ago, had to do with alligator and crocodile and found that it was expressly preempted with respect to that.
But with the kangaroo, it was not.
With the wallaby, it was not.
And that's one of the kangaroo we're concerned with?
No. No. We're dealing with the red kangaroo and the gray kangaroo.
Mr. Feinman, could you address the last sentence of Section 6F of the Endangered Species Act, the
Yes, Your Honor.
Preemption provision, and I'm particularly concerned about the term that permits states to have laws that are more restrictive.
Yes, Your Honor. There are three sentences in Section 6F, and I believe actually opposing counsel relies on the first sentence rather than the third, but all three certainly come into play. The third sentence reads, any state law or regulation respecting the taking of an endangered or threatened species may be more restrictive than the exemptions or permits provided for in this chapter or in any regulation which implements this chapter, but not less restrictive than the prohibition so defined. So there, I'm reminded of my law school professor that warned that, you know, the cardinal rule in interpreting a statute is read the statute, then read the statute again, then read it again. There are at least two reasons why the last sentence of Section 6F has no application to this case whatsoever. First, it only has to do with taking of animals. And this statute does not even purport to address taking of animals. Taking is a defined term of the Species Act that has to do with the harvesting, the culling of the species. And this does not even purport to address the means of taking of kangaroo. This has to do with importation, sale, and possession for commercial purposes. The second reason why it doesn't apply is because that last sentence of Section 6F only applies to endangered or threatened species. And as we know, While the red and gray kangaroo were at one time listed as threatened species, they are not now. So by its very terms, the last sentence of Section 6F has no application to this case whatsoever.
Mr. Fineman,
yes.
When the federal law was first enacted, the federal government obviously was concerned with the threatened extinction of the species of kangaroos. What I personally find important in this particular case is that after the 1974 enactment by Congress, we have a sequence of events which I think would make it harder for you to win, at least in my personal view, as you did in the Court of Appeal, which found your argument quite persuasive, and I believe the trial court did also. But in 1979, just a few years after Congress's enactment of the law in question, the Fish and Wildlife Service reconsidered the listing for the three species of kangaroos involved. There was a finding that these species were still threatened, but I think the federal government also found that Australia had put into effect very good policies to preserve these particular species of kangaroos. Then, in 1983, we have the Fish and Wildlife Service looking at the situation again. And it seems that there was a terrible drought in Australia that was again threatening these particular kangaroos. Our federal government, however, continued, even though it kept these species on the threatened list, it continued the special rule that it had adopted earlier, allowing the importation into this country of kangaroo leather products on to 1989. Animal preservation groups were petitioning the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service to put an end to the special rule that would allow the importation of kangaroo products. And in response, our federal government sent some committee to Australia to evaluate the situation. Then, in 1995, our federal government removed from the endangered species list these three species of kangaroos. It would appear, at least to me personally, that the sequence of events that I have just summarized in this court does not establish an existing federal policy that enforcement of the state statute at issue would obstruct. In 1974, when the federal government took action, these species were threatened. Then in 1995, based upon biological criteria, that there was no longer any danger to these three species of kangaroos, the federal government delisted. To me, the delisting, shows that there no longer is an existing federal concern, and that the termination of federal regulation leaves the field open for states to regulate as they see fit. I presume you would disagree, and I would like to hear from you why.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes. There's actually, I think, two questions implicit. One is the history that led up to the action in 1995, and then the second part of the question, I think, is what is the import of the delisting decision? The history leading up to 1995, I think, bless you, consistently shows a concern and a monitoring and a federal policy with respect to the kangaroo. There is the initial listing as threatened, together with the special rule that if the Australian states implement population management practices and policies that are satisfactory to the United States government, then we will allow importation. And that's exactly what occurred over the next several years. And eventually, as Your Honor has described, the Fish and Wildlife Service did allow the carrot and stick approach, did allow as a reward for the sound kangaroo management.
Yeah, but that, the carrot and stick approach to me is in the past, and I keep focusing on later events, particularly after all of the events that I summarized to you. Then we look at the 1995 delisting of these particular species.
Yes, and let's focus on that part of the question. In other words, does a delisting mean that there is no longer an express policy by the federal government with respect to the kangaroo? And I think the answer to that question is undeniably there is still a policy. It would only...
How could there be if in 1995 our federal government says we are taking these three species of kangaroos off the endangered list, which I presume could lead to an argument, and I think one that can reasonably be made, that given that delisting by the federal government, states are free to come up with whatever whatever state law they want to come up with pertaining to importation of products from dead kangaroos or whatever.
In 1995, the Fish and Wildlife Service delisted these three species of kangaroo as formerly having been threatened. And the question is, what is the import of that action? Well, altogether in that action, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the federal government, took a number of specific actions. One is, as there's been some questioning about it, the Fish and Wildlife Service and the federal government announced that it would conduct monitoring of the population management practices of Australia with regard to these species of kangaroo. So there is monitoring going on. And
when you talk about monitoring, are you referring to the proposed monitoring at that time of 5 years? And as I recall the record, those 5 years are passed.
That's not correct, Your Honor.
No.
What was proposed was monitoring for at least 5 years. And according to the record, that monitoring has continued all the way up to the time of the summary judgment, and indeed continues to this day. The monitoring is ongoing. It has to, by law, be for a minimum of 5 years. But in fact, in the case of the kangaroo, it continued on past that time and continues to this very day. Furthermore, as the Court of Appeal noted with respect to this issue of whether delisting means the end of the policy, in fact, the federal government continues to list one species of kangaroo as endangered and six species of wallaby kangaroo as threatened. Third, in fact, with respect to the exact species we're talking about today, the red and gray kangaroo, a subspecies of the eastern gray continues to be on the endangered species list, and indeed, in that very Federal Register action that delisted the gray and red kangaroo, continued the listing of a subspecies of eastern gray as endangered, and continued that in effect. So it seems a little interesting to me that appellants say that there is no continued monitoring, there is no policy with respect to the western and eastern gray kangaroo and the red kangaroo, when indeed a subspecies of the eastern gray called the Tasmaniensis continues to be listed.
Now let's take what you just said, that this subspecies continues to be listed as endangered.
Yes.
And how does that impact California's effort to ban the importation, I presume, of that subspecies as well as other species?
Well, that would come under Section 6F. So that would be an instance of express preemption. California cannot regulate in the area in that area, and I think appellant would concede that. I think appellant did, in fact, concede as much in her earlier argument. A further point about the impact of delisting and of the particular action that the Fish and Wildlife Service took when it delisted these species is that Fish and Wildlife has the power to monitor and to relist, including on an emergency basis at any time. And it's important to remember that this business of listing and emergency listing, BIBA attempts to present that as something that's sort of pro forma, that it could be done with respect to any species at any time, whether it was ever listed to begin with or not. Monitoring is an important feature of the Endangered Species Act. In fact, it was added as an amendment in 1978 to the statute because it was so important, this issue of monitoring and emergency relisting. I think it ill becomes appellants to characterize that as somehow pro forma or meaningless when it is an important feature of the statute, one that was particularly addressed in the Federal Register action was the delisting, that they continue to monitor, that they have this power to relist, that they can do it at any time, they can do it on an emergency basis if some threat occurs, and that could, as one of the elements of that, could include, in fact, a new import ban, if that's what the federal government deemed to be appropriate. I would like perhaps to spend another moment on the Bronco Wine case that I've been asked about before. It seems to me that this issue of conflict preemption is a special interest of this court. There have been several conflict preemption cases that the court has decided just in recent years, including not only the Bronco Wine case, but the Jevny versus Superior Court case, as well as the Olszewski versus Scripps Hospital case. All just in the last few years. I'm aware of at least one other conflict preemption case on the court's docket at this time, the farm-raised salmon case. And I would submit that this case is like Jevny and Olszewski, which both found conflict preemption to be the case and the state law to be preempted, and less like Bronco Wine for the reasons that I've mentioned previously. Jevny is an interesting case, which the court no doubt will recall, precisely because the conflict between the federal law and the state law was, in fact, somewhat slight. As the court will remember, Jevny concerned state standards for arbitrator disclosures and disqualification. And the disclosures that were required under the state standards were somewhat more detailed than the NASD standards for arbitrator disclosure. As the court indicated, one could, in fact, view the differences as somewhat a draftsmanship, that the NASD disclosures required, in slightly more general terms, for a neutral arbitrator to disclose any circumstance that would preclude that arbitrator from acting in an objective and impartial manner. In contrast, the state standards required that the arbitrator provide answers to a detailed set of questions that essentially address the same point. Nevertheless, the court found that, first, that it was not impossible for someone to comply with both sets of standards. But nonetheless, that set of state standards were preempted because it stood as an obstacle and therefore to the accomplishment of the federal goals, and therefore it was preempted by the federal NASD standards. And the court announced the standard for conflict preemption at page 956 of the opinion and said that the remaining question is whether the detailed disclosure requirements of the California standards in any significant way impede or impair accomplishment of the NASD and therefore the goals of the Securities Exchange Act. So the question is whether that state statute, in the words of this court, in any significant way impair or impede the accomplishment of the federal goals. And it is certainly true that Section 653O, which criminalizes trade in kangaroo products, in a significant way, in a very significant way, impairs or impedes the accomplishment of the federal goals, which expressly allow the importation and trade in kangaroo.
And what are the federal goals? You were speaking of the goals. Yes.
I am. Quite simply, Your Honor, under the Endangered Species Act, it is to conserve the kangaroo. And a conserve or conservation is a defined term in the Endangered Species Act, which has to do with management of the population of the species in question, which expressly, according to that definition, can include regulated taking.
So is this back to the carrot and the stick approach? When California prohibits importation and the federal goal is to conserve the species, I'm trying to figure out how California law conflicts with the federal law.
Certainly, Your Honor.
You may respond, Mr. Feinman, your time is otherwise up.
Okay, thank you very much. This goes really right to the heart of this carrot and stick approach as expressed in Crosby and the Garamendi cases. It's not for a state to decide out of the various means that might be chosen to accomplish a goal which is the best. The federal government is entitled to decide that a velvet glove approach as opposed to iron fist or a carrot as opposed to a stick is the best approach. And states, particularly in areas such as this, it impacts on international commerce, is simply not allowed to second-guess the goals that have been chosen by the federal government. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Feinman. Ms. Degani, we'll hear from you by way of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So what is your view pertaining to the delisting by the federal government? I'm sure you heard a question from the bench and the answer from opposing counsel, and now I would like to hear your response.
I completely agree with what you were suggesting in your question, which is in 1995, when these three kangaroo species were delisted, the federal government stopped having a policy with respect to the three species. And I'll talk about the particular points that Mr. Feinman made. First, the fact that they ordered monitoring for, as he says, at least 5 years. Again, that monitoring provision is in the Endangered Species Act. It's required any time a species is delisted. And I'm very surprised that Mr. Feinman is saying that there's evidence that that monitoring not only happened for those 5 years after 1995, which would have ended in 2000, but it's continued thereafter, and that there's evidence that it's ongoing to this day, because there, in fact, is no evidence in the record to that effect at all. The only evidence in the record is that in 1995, the Fish and Wildlife Service said in the Federal Register that it would implement this required monitoring for 5 years. Then there's evidence that the defendants printed out from the Fish and Wildlife Service's website a page in 2003 that said that in 1995 these three kangaroo species were listed as delisted being monitored. In 1995. It doesn't say anything about what was happening in 2003. It simply wasn't changed. It doesn't indicate as of 2003 still being monitored. You can bet that if there was such evidence, Adidas would have put it in. This is a company that's gone to the legislature three times to try to get Section 6530 changed so that it would not apply to these three kangaroo species, and is currently in front of the legislature again, a fourth time, trying to do the same thing. If they had that evidence, they would have put it in, and they don't have it because there is no current federal policy and there is no ongoing monitoring. Same thing with the emergency relisting. We're not claiming that that's a nothing provision. We're not making light of it at all. It's a very important provision. I'm representing an animal protection group here. We love that provision. But it does apply to any species on the planet. Any species that the Secretary receives a petition that says there's an imminent threat to this species, the Secretary has the right to immediately list that species without going through the usual lengthy process that's required for listing.
So in a nutshell, I presume your argument can be characterized as follows. Under federal law, the status of the delisted species is the same as if they had never been listed. And so, according to your view, the federal government has no ongoing interest or concern under the Endangered Species Act with which state law could conflict.
Correct. Absolutely correct. It has no interest, any more interest than it does with any other species that has never been listed. And in fact, the criteria that were used to determine to delist the kangaroo is exactly the same criteria that's used when a petition is made to list and the Fish and Wildlife Service decides not to list. So it's exactly the same determination that was made, and they've now delisted them, and they no longer have a policy with respect to these three kangaroo species. And as you've said, the states are now free to do as they please with them. I want to point out a couple of things. Mr. Feinman started with reading from the page 439 of the clerk's transcript, claiming that there the Fish and Wildlife Service says in the Federal Register that there is a permission that it's specific trade in these species is in these three kangaroo species is specifically allowed. I just want to point out that that page discusses the 1981 delisting the 1981 decision to allow the importation. They were still listed as threatened, but it was the 1981 decision to lift the import ban, not the 1995 decision to delist, which is a completely different situation. After the 1995 delisting, there was no longer a permission to import. There simply was no policy whatsoever. It was not permitted, but it wasn't forbidden.
Let me just ask you this question. I know that we're focused on what the federal government's policy is on the kangaroo. I guess one concern I have would be international trade repercussions. Let's assume that this court adopted your position, and in response, the Commonwealth of Australia reacted by banning all imports of fruits and vegetables from the United States. What can the federal government do about that?
The federal government at any time can preempt a state law that it feels is contrary to the federal government's
interest.
So
it's really a political question? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying it's a this case is a political question that this court cannot decide. What I'm saying is that, first of all, we have no evidence that Australia is going to react negatively to what this court does with this case, because, in fact, it's told us that it has every intention to continue protecting the kangaroo, which is the only thing that the defendants have said is the reason that the California law should be.
But I think any time a state bans the importation and sale of a product that is otherwise legal, you do have the prospect of some type of reaction to that. And so I'm posing the issue to you, if this were to happen and the Commonwealth of Australia reacted by simply banning fruits and vegetables from the United States, what's the remedy that the U.S. government would have?
And that, I agree, is a political decision to be made. The U.S. government at any time can preempt a California law that it thinks is interfering with foreign policy. But that's not to say that any state law that touches on foreign policy is therefore by definition preempted. And I also want to point out that Section 653-0 is not a statute that deals with foreign policy. It prohibits trade and importation of a variety of species, some of which are indigenous to California, some of which are not, some of which are from foreign countries, some of which are from other states, like Florida.
It
seems to me that at least on the issue of whether there's a presumption in favor or against prevention, the fact that we are in talking about international trade would have to enter into the question of whether we start with a presumption for it or against it. You agree with that?
I disagree with that. I disagree. I think that what both the U.S. Supreme Court and this court have said is that if it's an area where there's been heavy federal involvement from forever, then that's an area where you do not apply a presumption against preemption. And this is not that kind of a case. I don't think any court has said to this point that any time you're dealing with a law that touches on foreign affairs, even incidentally, that there's a presumption that law is preempted. I think
can't
there
we,
you look to see
can't we presume
there's a conflict.
That because Congress has the authority to preempt state action in this area, that Congress has concluded for the time being that there is no interference with foreign commerce that justifies congressional intervention, and that if Congress changes its perception of that, it's has the authority to do something about it. And since they haven't.
Absolutely.
Well, we don't have the Commerce Clause issue before us at this point. Is that correct?
Correct.
We're only dealing with this very narrow issue of preemption.
Preemption, correct. I also want to just point out quickly a couple of other things that came up when Mr. Feinman was speaking. The Book v. Brown case did not there was not a decision there that the ban on importation of alligators and crocodiles is preempted. There was a decision that because the particular defendant in that case had a federal permit, then Section 653-0 was preempted with respect to that defendant. So that's not the situation that we have here. Here there's nobody has a permit that's specifically granted by the federal government to import these three species of kangaroos. So there's the preemption that applied in the Fuke v. Brown case is simply not applicable here.
Counsel, would you also comment on his characterization of the Justin case?
Yeah.
He said it's an express preemption, and was it applied in an obstacle preemption case?
You may respond, but your time is otherwise up.
Okay. I want to say for both the Manhang and the H.J. Justin cases, they did not, as Mr. Feinman says, strictly hold that Section 653-0 is preempted. They held that it's preempted with respect to African elephants because there was a special rule, just like the special rule that was applicable to kangaroos between 1981 and 1995, that allowed the importation. So there was a permission by the federal government that the state could not interfere with. But as to species for which there was no permission, that were not on the list, and those were the wallaby kangaroo and the Indonesian python, both foreign species, both touching on foreign affairs, there was no preemption, and the state was free to regulate as it saw fit as to those two species. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Tagani. Thank you, Mr. Feinman. The matter stands submitted.